Thank you for listening to Soho Bites, the only podcast in the world, as far as we're aware, dedicated to talking about films set in Soho, the beating heart of bohemian cosmopolitan London. If you would like to support the show, you can do this in the form of a star rating or review at sohobitespodcast.com/review. Or if you'd like to put a small amount of money where your mouth is, you can do that at sohobitespodcast.com/donate. Donations can be from as little as £3, which will buy, at London prices, about half a drink for one of our thirsty guests. You may hear some different URLs in the upcoming episode, but by far the easiest way is to follow one of those links. They are, again, sohobitespodcast.com/review and sohobitespodcast.com/donate. Thank you for your continued support and enjoy the episode.
The following program contains discussions of a sexual nature and some rude words, including Willy.
Hello and welcome to the much delayed episode 48 of Soho Bites. Soho Bites is the podcast in which we talk about Soho and the films that are set there. My name is Dominic DeLaghi, and after a break of nearly 2 years, Soho Bites is back, with my apologies for the extended hiatus. What could possibly have caused, you're wondering, or maybe you're not wondering, maybe you don't care, but what could possibly have caused such a long gap between episodes? Well, I could drone on about this forever, but to be brief, I've just been very busy. I used to have a day job at a well-known public broadcaster and could usually find time between live programmes and on weekend shifts to fit in other stuff like Soho Bites. But since taking voluntary redundancy and going freelance a couple of years ago, I just don't have that downtime anymore. Trying to adjust to this freelance feast or famine lifestyle has been tricky. I was either working, or if I wasn't working, I was trying to find work, but I've now settled down into a comfortable routine. And although I had thought at one point about shutting Soho Bites down and archiving all the episodes somewhere, I've decided instead to bring the show back, so here we are. I have 6 monthly episodes planned and another 6 standing by, so now is the time to subscribe, if you haven't done so already, at sohobitespodcast.com. The film we're talking about in this episode is the 1986 classic Mona Lisa. Directed by Neil Jordan and written by David Leyland, it comes from the much-missed Handmade Films, so George Harrison gets an executive producer credit. It stars Bob Hoskins, Kathy Tyson in her breakout film role, Michael Caine in not his breakout film role, and Robbie Coltrane. It's the film that demonstrates that even in the most dire circumstances, in a world of cruelty and exploitation, when all around you people are swimming in filth and degradation, it's still possible to find redemption and human connection. I'll be talking about Mona Lisa in a conversation that took place many months ago now with Soho's very own cigar-chomping cliche of a film producer, they're his words, not mine, Colin Vaines. Colin's been on the show before and has a long history of working in the UK film industry, which gives him some very interesting insights into the making of Mona Lisa. That's coming up in part 2, but before that, for what I like to call the thematically linked supporting feature, I'll be delving into one specific aspect of Soho's murky history. The Soho portrayed in Mona Lisa is a sleazy neighbourhood, a grim and intimidating place with sex shops, clip joints, strip clubs, brothels and peep shows on every corner, and in most places in between. We see a lot of this in the notorious montage section of the film, in which Bob Hoskins walks the streets of Soho to a soundtrack of In Too Deep by Genesis. Although the film gives us a heightened version of reality, those street scenes and the interiors of the establishments are real, and many of us will remember those times. Normal businesses like restaurants, delicatessens, coffee shops and tailors jostled for space with the sex shops, and in many cases were jostled out by the sex shops, And the film does show Soho as it really was in those last days before the big clean-up. The way Soho had become by the early 80s was a result of many different factors, including, weirdly, its geography. But London's porn industry didn't start in Soho, as our guest in part one will explain. This square mile stuffed with multiple different iterations of the commercial sex industry had evolved over many decades. In fact, it had been evolving for over 100 years, with this evolution spurred on by developments in technology and by a constantly changing cast of shady but entrepreneurial pornographers, gangsters, bookshop owners, and, of course, corrupt coppers. To find out about this decades-long development of the British porn industry, I went along to the gallery of the Museum of Soho at 75 Dean Street, where I met up with Oliver Carter. Oliver is a professor in creative economies at Birmingham City University and is currently deep in a long research project called Under the Counter, which looks at the business of hardcore pornography in the UK from its early days in Victorian times right up until the present day. From reading his book, also called Under the Counter, there were three specific products I was interested in hearing about: the intriguingly named Soho Postcards, Soho Bibles, and Rollers, which together form the mainstay of hardcore porn output in the mid-20th century. But what were those three things? Before we got onto this, Oliver took us all the way back to the mid-19th century and to a West End street that no longer exists.
You can trace sexual enterprise in London around obscene material to Holywell Street. And Holywell Street was known for its secondhand bookstores and its bookshops. And initially it was selling radical material, but that evolved into obscene material, books, artworks and photographs. But obviously they were fewer than books. Books were easier to produce than photographs. The introduction of the first Obscenity Act in 1857 was an attempt to try and control this trade, but not just pornography as we'd come to refer to it as today, but more, as I said, radical pamphlets and other things that could be determined to disrupt the status quo. But it's a very busy street. It was quite narrow. And as people were able to reproduce pornography easier, books would be imported in from Belgium and France. They wouldn't be cheap. If you wanted to get something stronger, you'd have to speak to the bookshop owner. They would be very wary to do that unless you were an established customer, just in case you were the police. The problem with Holywell Street was that it just became impossible to police. So as the trade grew, you'd put one shop out of business, but then another one would replace. It's like a whack-a-mole effect. So by the early 1900s, the Society for the Suppression of Vice and the police effectively just thought, well, the best thing to do actually is to just raise it. So the Strand replaces Holywell Street and Wych Street. And what happened to the trade is it moved up, it relocated to the Strand, then to Charing Cross, and then eventually into Soho.
Soho this week, the shadowy square mile behind the Christmas lights of Oxford Street, teeming with clip joints and night spots. The West End has 500 nightclubs, a breeding ground for protection. In Soho, men walk in fear.
So why did it move to Soho? Well, if you look at a map, you can see Soho's a contained space. You've got Regent Street, you've got Oxford Street, you've got Charing Cross Road, you've got all these roads around it. So it's very easy for your shopper to just disappear into Soho. It was known for sexual enterprise, so sex work was common. You had the Hooper's Hotel brothel in Soho Square. You had a space of general tolerance. So it's a cosmopolitan bohemian culture, a very relaxed atmosphere. So it's very hard to police Soho. And if anyone comes to Soho, it's really easy to get lost. If you don't know Soho well, if you don't understand how the thoroughfares work, you can very easily get lost in the many courts. So it's ideal for criminality, because what you could do is you could easily nick something, or you could sell something and then run it out of the shop and go and run down one of the courts and get, you know, run away from someone really easily. So it was an ideal contained space. And I think that's one of the reasons why we see the trade move from there down in the Strand up into Soho, because it was hard to police, it was a tolerant atmosphere, and it already had a relationship with sexual enterprise. By the 50s, there were around 4 or 5 bookshops in Soho. And if you wanted to buy this material, what we'd classify as hardcore today, you'd have to go to a bookshop. And what you do is you walk into this bookshop, very acceptable from the outside. Might be some like suggestive covers, but you go into the shop and you would see glamour books, or you would just see books of fiction. And then you would see a man behind the counter. This would be called the chair, and it would always be a man. I'm told that sometimes women would not be permitted into these shops. And this man was the guardian of the back room. And the back room is where in the 50s you would have a briefcase of stock that would probably include some French books, so the explicit books, maybe some hand-drawn erotica, which would be explicit, and potentially some photographs. And the reason why it was in a briefcase was because if the police came in to raid you, you could just close the bookshop up. And there was one shop that I was told where you could drop it out the back of the shop and there'd be a runner waiting just in case it'd be paid. Young lad would be paid to just run the briefcase to a safe spot until it was safe to open up trade again. But you had to get access to that. So you had to be trusted. You had to be a paying customer and you weren't allowed to browse. It was you had to ask what you wanted and do your business and get out. And the chair was the person who ran the shop and they were the person who guarded the inner sanctum of the back room. By the late 1950s, you would have had photographs being sold. So the Soho postcards, packs of 5 in cellophane, and they would usually either be in the briefcase or hanging up on some pinboard, and they would show either couples or groups having sex explicitly. They'd be categorized sometimes in boxes, but in the early days there wouldn't be many. There would be a small amount. They would be sold to the shops by the pornographers who made them on sale or return. If they sold, they'd go back at the end of the week and collect their money. So I think it was 32p you could wholesale a pack of black and white postcards for, and they'd sell them at the shop for £1. So the reason why the bookshops became so lucrative, and it was a good business move to open a bookshop, because the markup, the profit margins were high. John Mason, bookshop owner, he started working in a shop called The Long Shop, which was on Old Compton Street. Very narrow shop. It's next to one of the pubs there. You can still see the alleyway. Well, that was the shop. And that was run by Tom Fletcher. Thomas Fletcher was a bohemian character, I'm told. Smoked French cigarettes. And he needed some work doing in a shop. So he brought a man in called John Mason, who was a scene shifter in the West End. Mason came and did some refitting for the shop and slowly became aware that there's quite a bit of money in this. His name was Ronald Eric Mason, but he was known as John. And Mason learned the trade from Fletcher, understood that police corruption, it paid well to pay the police. And he opened, I think, had 5 shops initially, and then had, I think his height, maybe 11, but he had a number of shops. But he befriended Ron Davey, a very sociable character, I'm told, giant of a man, loved life and soul of a party. He said, well, why don't you, we sell books, we sell photographs, why don't you combine the two products into one? The Soho Bible was born. And what you'd do is you'd have a story written by some pilled up wannabe erotic author, and you would illustrate those with Soho postcards stuck in. Now, the images on the cards would not match the story, so you'd have a hybrid of a book and a series of postcards. So you'd have 5 photos, usually, that would be glued in to a book, typewritten book, and they would just be stuck in at random, in random places. And the markup on those was huge, so much so, he's said to be the first person to make $1 million from making pornography, where Mason was said to be one of the first millionaire bookshop owners, and they created an exclusive partnership. And then another thing happens is people with their disposable incomes are buying 8mm home movies to watch on their projectors at home. So if you want to watch a film, you had to go to the cinema. If you want to watch a home, you had to buy an 8mm film, which would usually be a short cut down of a silent feature. A couple of people like Ivor Cook, Leonard Thor, and Ken Skinny Taylor were all professional photographers, and they clearly spotted a gap in the market. So they could see that photographs were becoming a bit of a crowded market, but they realized, well, we could make films. And they learned how to do that, and they started selling what became rollers, 15-minute, 8mm films, black and white, showing hardcore sex, usually group sex. They were called rollers because when you played them back on an 8mm projector, they would roll. So they would be called loops in America, stag films as well, but we in Britain, in the trade, they called them rollers. So Rollers were expensive. We've already established that it was if you were earning £22 a week, that would probably buy you one roller a week. So this would be a luxurious purchase. So the people buying them were people of means, you know. I know that some celebrities at the time were regular customers to Soho. So the late Bob Monkhouse was a collector of all film and was regularly seen in some shops in Soho. You could sometimes return them and get half price on the next thing you bought from the shop. Because, again, it's the age of scarcity. All these different economic models were introduced and used. Library systems were sometimes introduced as well. But if you couldn't watch a film in the privacy of your own home and you couldn't afford a projector, or you just didn't feel comfortable showing a film at home, you could go and watch a Blue Movie show. So occasionally you'd have someone in Soho come up to you. If you look like a tourist, say, do you want to come to a Blue Movie show? And you'd say, okay, and you'd pay you £5. That was generally the going rate. And they'd either drive you to somewhere in Marylebone, or there'd be somewhere in Soho, and you'd go into a residential property and you would watch a roller in the group of other people, and then you would leave. Sometimes there'd be a couple having sex. Sometimes there might be a sex worker present. But that was one way, and that made it more accessible. These were called Blue Movie shows.
I played in this street as a kid, so obviously I've seen a few changes. And the basic change I've seen is lack of residential, lack of speciality shops, and more of what is now considered the norm, the pound, the vast, what have you.
So the system, so if you wanted to open a bookshop in Soho to sell porn in the 1960s, first, you'd have to get permission from Bernie Silver. Bernie Silver was the godfather of Soho, and I'm very skeptical of these, you know, these type of monikers, but that's what he was referred to as, the godfather of Soho. He was a former protege of the notorious Messina brothers, who were Maltese pimps who ran Vice in Soho, real nasty group of people. Silver learned the trade through them and was effectively a glorified pimp. He was a flat farmer. So when the changes in sex work law were introduced and pushed sex workers from the streets into the flats, people like Bernie Silver made loads of money because they needed a place to work. He owned the flats and he would charge high rents for the women to use them. And he teamed up with a guy called Big Frank Mifsud, who was a former traffic policeman from Malta. And he acted as Silver's enforcer. And what Silver did was build relationships with the highest ranking police officers at the Metropolitan Police. And this was through bribing them. So this meant that Silver was effectively given control of policing Soho. This worked well for the police because it meant that they could leave it to be controlled by the gangsters, and they would also know about crime before it happened. So someone I interviewed, a journalist, told me, well, we call this effective policing. He said, because it basically meant that they could find out about crimes before it happened. And they relatively kept the peace in Soho until 1972 through this system. Now, people still fell out of windows and there was still violence. I'm not, you know, trying to say these weren't violent people, but the whole ethos of Bernie Silver was, this is good for business. We're all making money, the police, the gangsters, the pornographers. Let's not shout about it. Let's keep it hidden. And that's how it works. So if you want to open a bookshop, you need permission from the police and from Bernie Silver. And if Bernie gave you the permission, you could then speak to, let's say, Chief Inspector Bill Moody of the Obscene Publications Squad, and you would pay them for a license or the cover or the insurance. The license is a term that was used, but it wasn't an official license. It was effectively a protection racket, but limited protection racket. So you could do your business if you paid, let's say, £100 a week. You'd be able to open up a shop. You would be able to sell in hardcore pornography in your back room, providing it's not in the window and it's in a back room. And again, it's respectable. You can do it. We will raid you occasionally, but just put the old stock out in front. And if we do raid you, or if there's a raid that's happening outside the Obscene Publication Squad, we'll give you a phone call in advance using the code name WH Smith or Menzies. And if you have that, you know that you're going to be raided. And this was the cost of doing business. So there was so much money to be made. You know, if a roller is selling for, let's say, £15, black and white roller, and they're buying that for a fiver, a Bible, I think, had like a £15 markup on as well. The profits that these shops were generating were absolutely massive. The private investigator, Matthew Oliver, his reports were passed on to the Sunday People under Laurie Manifold, and they then in 1972 reported on the relationship between the police chief and the pornographer Jimmy Humphries. They reported on Evan Phillips. Everyone got exposed, and suddenly, oh my God, the Metropolitan Police are corrupt and the trade collapsed.
Westminster Council set out to control rather than close down Soho's sex industry and have been quick to use the powers to license sex shops granted by Parliament last February. Soho hoped for 21 licences. Only 6 were granted. 15 sex shops closed down, but 15 moved into the unlicensed realms of nude encounter parlours, nude photographic studios, and topless bars serving anything but real beer. It's a loophole Westminster want to plug, but they're happy with the clean-up so far.
A number of laws were introduced. So the Indecent Displays Act was the first thing that was introduced to try and bolster the Obscene Publications Act. And that was in 1981. It's prompted by the rapid spread of sex shops, especially David Sullivan's chain outside of Soho. And it was a concern of them being next door to schools or in suburban neighbourhoods. What the Act did, it banned open displays of pornography. So then pornography shops had to black out their windows. That made them look more secretive or more intimidating. And they used that highly descriptive signage, "Do not enter. There are acts of sexual intercourse for sale here." So it didn't have any effect. But the law that did have the biggest impact on Soho was the Local Government Act of 1982. And that gave the councils the power to, ironically, license sex shops. But officially, and then Westminster were the first council to adopt it straight away, and they set the licence fee at £5,000. Initially, there was going to be 10 to 20 shops allowed, so that would be a massive reduction from the 62, but 31 applied and only 9 were granted licences in 1984. What that eventually resulted in was the gentrification of Soho. Mona Lisa captures the moment when Soho is just about to change, because they actually went into some of the shops. They weren't knocked up shops. They were actually the sex shops. Neil Jordan, in the audio commentary to Mona Lisa, he said that the producer didn't want me to have this sequence in because he thought it was garish. He said, but I insisted. He said, well, if you're going to do it, you've got to do a montage and put some music behind it. So they chose Genesis. I don't know why, but it's something to do with searching for someone, isn't it? So anyway, they arranged to film in Soho between 12 a.m. and 4 a.m. And they said they would pay the shops £200 each if they would offer the location up. And they wanted to keep the lights on to make it look like it was alive. However, they arrived early. And this is what one of the sex shop owners, Dave, told me. And obviously, when there's a film crew in Soho and the shops are still open, people probably aren't likely to be going into those shops. So it wasn't good for business. So word got round that they're paying £200, but, you know, they were taking the piss a little bit. So they all agreed that at 12 a.m, they were going to turn the lights of the shops off, all of them. And that if they wanted the lights to be turned on, they're going to have to pay £700. So Michael Caine's walking around with Bob Hoskins as well. They're having pictures taken with some of the sex shop boys and everything. Westminster Council are in the area because obviously they're aware it's being shot. And then 12 a.m, all the lights go off. And they said, we're not going to turn them back on. So a few minutes later, someone with an envelope starts going around to the shops paying £700 each. And the lights were turned back on and they shot the sequence. The shop that Bob Hoskins goes into, which I think is on Tisbury, potentially. And he goes into Tisbury, and that's how the shop would have been working. So it's how you would see the shop in the day. So you can see the VHS and the mags, or the VHS softcore. I wonder what might be under the counter, potentially, but that was a Maltese shop. And so that's why Mona Lisa is quite important, because it captures perhaps that last moment when Soho's sexual economy was truly swinging.
Thank you to Professor Oliver Carter of Birmingham City University for coming on the show and sharing some of the fruits of his 10 years of research into this shady topic. Oliver has a website called Under the Counter where you can buy his book. There are more to come, by the way. He's only a third of the way through this project, and the archive of the material he collected in the course of his research is now housed at the Bishopsgate Institute right by Liverpool Street Station. Links for all of these can be found in the show notes for this episode at SohoBitesPodcast.com. Hello, this is what's known as a mid-roll ad. It's one of those annoying interruptions that's inserted retrospectively at just the wrong point. And the reason for it is that Soho Bites takes up hours of time every month, and I'm hoping you might be able to support the show. There are two ways you can do this. One is for free, and it's to leave the show a star rating or kind review. You can do that at sohobitespodcast.com/review, or if you'd like to assist financially to help cover our costs, you can do that at sohobitespodcast.com/donate. Thank you very much. Apologies for the interruption, and back to the episode. The central character of 1986's Mona Lisa is George, played by Bob Hoskins. He's recently been paroled after a 7-year stretch. We never actually find out what George did to get banged up, but we can gather he was taking the rap in some way for a sleazy gangster and strip club owner called Denny Mortwell, played by Michael Caine. After his release, seemingly as some sort of compensation, George is given some employment by Mortwell. A simple job, to drive a high-class sex worker called Simone, played by Kathy Tyson, from job to job. Over the course of the film, the gauche and naive George and the much more sophisticated and worldly Simone develop an unlikely friendship. Rather like a classic rom-com, the relationship begins fractiously but ends in a kind of love, but never a kiss is exchanged. This is an intense, platonic love that develops as Simone gradually begins to trust George, and he, finding out more about the world she inhabits, tries to help her in her quest to track down her friend, Kathy, another sex worker who's gone missing. Their relationship is pure, mostly honest, and actually very touching.
Kathy. Her name's Kathy. She's a Londoner. She has a tattoo on her hand there. I promised I'd look after her. Things can happen out there.
Out where?
On the streets, in the clubs. I can't go down. But you could. I'll pay you.
Yeah.
Any way I can. I want to find her. You know the way it is. You're a good man, Mr. George.
How can you tell?
On the other hand, George's relationship with his ex-wife is diabolical. After he's released from prison, though, he attempts to patch up what's left of his relationship with his daughter, Jeannie, played by Zoe Nathanson.
Jeannie, get inside.
Just
inside,
don't do this to me.
You've been away too fucking long. I don't know.
Just a minute.
She don't know you, George, and she don't want to know you.
She's my daughter.
You, don't want
you to can't
know
do this to me. I only came to see her. You can't do this to me. I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
George.
You can't.
It doesn't go 100% according to plan. The other valued connection in George's life, he doesn't have many, is with his loyal friend Thomas, played by Robbie Coltrane. Thomas lives in a caravan inside his workshop in a railway arch, from where he appears to be running a business, buying and selling strange novelty items. It's the presence of Thomas which perhaps goes some way to explaining some of the peculiarities of the film, because although on the surface, Mona Lisa appears to be a gritty, noirish crime drama, it has a jarring, not quite real edge to it. We may wonder if the whole thing is just a flashback, or maybe a made-up story told to Thomas by George. Why does King's Cross look like some kind of fantasy hellscape? Why, at the start of the film, does George buy an enormous white rabbit which is never referred to again? Is this a signal that we're about to fall down Alice in Wonderland's rabbit hole? It's almost like surrealism, wearing the clothes of gritty reality. Throughout the film, whenever the two friends get together, Thomas gives George the latest developments in a novel he's reading, a real-life book called The Deadly Percheron by John Franklin Bardeen. Fantastic book, by the way, you should definitely read it.
So what happened to the dwarf after he ran off with the...
The Percheron?
Yeah, sorry.
Well, it goes back to the psychiatrist's office.
What, the horse does?
No, the dwarf. He's got another session, right? And just as he's leaving the office...
Another murder.
How did you know that?
I'm good at these things. And don't tell me it was the lawyer's wife.
No, it was the horse.
Well, the horse did the murder. Murdered the lawyer's wife.
Not a fucking lawyer's wife. The horse. The horse was the victim, right? It was the horse that got murdered.
Well, with an ice pick.
Yeah, that'd be good. I like that.
There are many parallels between the Dudley Percheron and Mona Lisa, and it's perhaps the key to understanding the film. The protagonist of the Dudley Percheron, also called George, finds himself, like our George, the Mona Lisa George, in a strange and confusing world where not everything is as it seems, and the stuff that is as it seems is strange and confusing. In both the book and the film, characters adopt elaborate constructed identities, and both our Georges are really just pawns in complex schemes and in a system about which they're entirely ignorant. Thomas's repeated references to the Dudley Percheron are a signal to the audience that we are not necessarily dealing with reality here, despite the grit and the grime. The final acts of both the book and the film take place in seaside towns. In the case of Mona Lisa, it's Brighton, referred to as Soho-on-Sea by many, including on previous episodes of this podcast, and it's a shockingly brutal climax, which I won't spoil for you, because that would spoil it. Colin Vaines has lived in the heart of Soho for many years, which must be handy for a film producer. Several months ago, before the long Soho Bites hiatus, he invited me to his flat just off Rupert Street, where we spoke at some length about Neil Jordan's semi-demi-monde Soho noir, Mona Lisa.
Mona Lisa.
My name is Colin Vaines, and I am, or as I always say, I produce films when they let me. I've worked in the film business for years. I started as a journalist originally, and then moved across to development, worked for the company that's now the BFI, it was called something else in the day, and then moved across to various companies, including Columbia Pictures and Miramax and Weinstein Co. and Graham King's company, and then I've been basically working as a freelancer ever since then.
We're in your flat in the heart of Soho, the very, very heart of Soho, I think. And can you say where it is exactly?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you want to get stalked?
No, I don't mind at all. I do mind. It's in Tisbury Court, which is a little courtyard. I mean, just to be boring for a second about the history of Soho or whatever, Soho was basically essentially laid out in the 17th century. It started then. And there was originally, apparently, a Diadem Court, which I don't even know whether they still call it Diadem Court. It's now where Crossrail is. That's one of those little roads that goes between Dean Street and Wardour Street. That was called Crown Court. And further down here, Tisbury Court was originally called Little Crown Court. And it's always been a funny little sort of cut through. They changed the name to Tisbury Court in 1937 for reasons nobody seems to know. But because it's in this sort of central spot within the square mile, which is in Soho, it seems to be the thing that people always focus on if they're going to make a movie about the sex business or the sex industry. People love this little courtyard, and they love Rupert Street that it goes onto, and then they love Walker's Court, which runs up above that. I saw a flat here in late 90s, and it wasn't very expensive, and I just liked the kind of vibe of the area. But these were the days when I would go out at night at 7:30 and come back 7:30 the following morning and have moved about 200 yards or whatever. Yeah. Whereas now, 7:30 at night, I'm thinking, I could be in bed in an hour's time.
Yeah, yeah, tell me about it. Tisbury Court was it was just absolutely rammed with signs and girls and beckoning you in. I mean, when I first came to Soho in the 80s, this was the road that was, you couldn't walk down without being dragged into some clip joint or something. And now it's kind of, it's not 100% cleaned up. There's two massage parlours and...
Yes. It's very odd. You look back on it now and you see the density of the sex shops and so on. And it's just something everybody lived with. It was also, remember, it was the heart of the film industry. This was the primary thing about it, was that everything around the film industry revolved around this area. Soho had been adopted by the film industry from a very early age. From about 1904, Charles Urban, who was a colour film pioneer, moved into Wardour Street. And there's still an Urban house there. the fact that there was the sex business going on was kind of secondary to the fact that, for me, it was the film industry that was the heart of what was happening there. All the major film companies maintained their offices here, and then bit by bit, as the rents and rates went up and they were given better deals in Hammersmith, that most of them moved out there. And it was left much more to cutting rooms and to dubbing rooms, all those kind of
Screening rooms,
it's were sort of left behind. And then a lot of those were kind of forced out by the rent and rate rises, and people moved north into Fitzrovia or whatever. But it still maintains some of its filmic vibe or whatever, but it's a very pale shadow compared to what it used to be.
And the film we're here to talk about is from 1986. It's Mona Lisa. Quite a lot of it's set in Soho. There are some other fantastic London locations, Gray's Inn Road and Blackheath and stuff. Could you set the film up for us? Tell us a little bit about it. What world are we in, and who are the main characters?
Sure. Well, Bob Hoskins plays a guy who comes out of prison. It's never explained what he did, but he did something for a big shot kind of gangster called Denny. And Hoskins, who plays a character called George, is looking to get something from this character that obviously let him down or abandoned him or whatever. And he goes to see him, and he basically gives him a job, which is driving a sex worker around, played by a young Kathy Tyson. And at first there's this kind of absolute dislike between them, because George thinks she's just a black tart, as he puts it so eloquently at one point, and she thinks he's a kind of an oik who's going to blow her cover all the time, and she's worked very hard to develop a more sophisticated image. But bit by bit they become closer and start to really understand each other as two kind of outsider figures. And she reveals to him that she's actually really keen to find an old friend of hers who's a younger sex worker and would love to know what happened. And he gets drawn into her plans.
And the key relationships that the film hangs around, there's obviously the George and Simone, that's Bob Hoskins. And there's also, which we'll talk about, there's also George and his friend Thomas, who's played Robbie Coltrane. And there's George and his daughter, who he's trying to develop, because the relationship with her fell to pieces when he went inside. He's trying to build it up again. Which is the main relationship for you, the George and Simone? And does it work? Because it feels like in their relationship there's a central deceit, because she's kind of using him for her own ends, which is to find this girl.
It's funny, if I think about the film, I think of it purely in terms of Hoskins. I mean, who I think is genuinely astonishing in the film. I mean, I hadn't watched the film since its first release, and coming back to it, I was absolutely astounded by the power of Hoskins' performance and the authenticity of it. It reminds me, the only actor I can think of working today in sort of British cinema that has that kind of quality is Stephen Graham, who I think is incapable of an inauthentic beat. And Hoskins is really amazing in this. So he does have these relationships with her, but she is remote. The whole Mona Lisa idea, the Nat King Cole song is used at the beginning, this sense that she is this unknowable presence that it's all about his projection onto her and what he feels. The film is so much about toxic masculinity and about men's inability to see women as women or as fully formed creatures in the same way as themselves without projecting these things on. And of course, the whole business of being a sex worker and the whole business of pornography or whatever is to kind of create something that's unreal. So he does have relationships with all those people, and they're all important in their own way. But ultimately, he's very much a loner character. There's a wonderful description of the film as being like Scorsese's Mean Streets filtered through Lionel Bart's Things Ain't What They Used to Be.
Yeah, that's quite good, actually.
and that sense of, actually even more than Mean Streets, obviously a big influence of the film is Taxi Driver, and this sense of the character trying to figure out. I mean, it's like saying in Taxi Driver, well, who's De Niro's relationship with? Well, it is with Betsy, the character. Campaign worker. He's desperately trying to make that work. And there are some moments where you see him connect with other people. But ultimately, these are loner characters who are battling their own demons, I think, in a way. And we see Hoskins alone at the beginning, coming out of prison. Really nice title sequence where you see London and you see him with his
dawn or sunset.
And he's sitting on this part of this bench and so on. And you don't really know who he is, what he is. You don't even know what he's doing, what he's carrying. And then gradually it becomes apparent that he's going to see his daughter and his ex-wife, and he's trying to, you know, kind of re-establish this connection or whatever.
You're talking about toxic masculinity, which is runs all the way through, and there is a horrific toxic, I mean, I think that toxic masculinity has come to mean bad behaviour in the workplace, whereas actually this is like the absolute degradation and humiliation of women by an organised way by the teams of men. But actually George he's appalled and disgusted by all of this. And it seems quite weird that he's so naive to that world. He's been delivering porn videos as part of his job. And he's a bit kind of shocked by how young the girls are in King's Cross and that kind of thing. And he has a vulnerability as well, which doesn't seem to sort of fit that toxic masculinity mold.
No, I suppose I found him completely believable. It's just, it's more that, I think everything you said is correct. He's shocked by the degrees of it. One assumes, and again, it's never explained what his job was in the past, what he did for this big shot gangster-like figure who's played by Michael Caine rather brilliantly in the film.
He's great. Best performance of Michael Caine I think I've seen, actually.
Brilliant. Apart from Get Carter, which was obviously a big influence on this. Yeah, I think that Hoskins is kind of has this purity almost, a naivety about the world.
Yeah, tell me something.
What?
Did I ever want you back?
Who?
Your clients.
Always.
What, they fall in love with you? Or do they?
Sometimes they fall for what they think I am.
What do I think you are?
What do you think? Black hole.
Did I say that?
What do you think then?
Well, you ain't no night nurse.
I ain't no night nurse.
Let's say you're a lady.
Why, thank you.
Neil Jordan had made Angel, for which Channel 4 picked up, which John Borman produced, which had a sort of magical... I mean, Neil was a novelist, bit of a poet, and he worked with John on Excalibur. He was kind of like, he became like a creative associate when John was shooting that in Ireland. And John produced his first film, Angel, which has this slightly heightened quality to it. Second film was Company of Wolves, which is obviously Angela Carter's fairy stories and so on put together. And Mona Lisa started because Chris Brown, who was a co-producer with Steve on some of his early films, brought him a cutting about a pimp. He was being accused of being a pimp who was on trial. And the girls were coming up and actually giving testimony on his behalf, saying, no, he wasn't this horrible pimp. He was a guy who was looking after us. There were really nasty people behind him. And that was the inspiration for the whole film, was the idea that someone who was in that world, but somehow was perceived to be the saviour figure or whatever, or a better figure than that. That started things off. And Neil and Steve Woolley spoke about it and decided that they thought, well, there's the makings of a film here, and they both loved Get Carter, and they thought about Michael Caine, and they both loved a TV film that David Leland had written called Made in Britain. They went to David, and he wrote a script which was apparently extremely violent and very tough, and very much with the idea that it was Michael Caine comes back into this world. And I don't know how close it was to the story that we see in the film, but it certainly had a lot of similar elements to it. Neil and Steve thought about it and talked about it and decided it wasn't the film they wanted to make. And I think this is the critical thing, is that one has to remember that Neil Jordan's interest was kind of slightly more artistic and poetic in a way, that he just made a film which was about a subversion of fairy stories in Company of Wolves. And I think that sense of the rather more naive character literally going down a rabbit hole into another world was something that he was very interested in. I think that, and then also by this point, it became clear that Kane wasn't going to be playing the lead in it, although he retained a connection to it and agreed to play this pretty horrific sort of villain. Somewhere along the line, Hoskins' name came up, but of course, they were all big fans of The Long Good Friday, like everybody was, and that had been such an extraordinary, powerful depiction of a gangster in that film. So I think that suddenly they started thinking about Bob, and that also coloured the way that the story started to develop, because Hoskins also had this sweetness and sensitivity, and that had been seen in things like Pennies from Heaven on television. So there was suddenly a whole different flavour and vibe to it. And from that point on, apparently David Leland didn't write anything more, but he would meet regularly with Neil and Steve, and they would talk about the script, and they would talk about developing the ideas. And it became apparent that Neil really was doing something quite different with the material. David said that the defining moment for him was when he got the script back. And in the script, Hoskins' character was off to see Michael Caine's character to try and, you know, see him back when he's out of prison, try and do what he do. And when the script came back to him early in one version, he went off to a pet shop and bought a rabbit. And David Leland was completely like, what the hell is going on here? I've no idea why he's doing this. And so Neil would constantly be looking for the slightly surreal in the situation. And he says that, because people would ask endlessly about why the rabbit, what's the rabbit doing? Because you see him buy the rabbit, he leaves it as a gift for the Michael Caine character.
It's a threatening gift in a way.
It's very odd. It's not explained at all in the film. And then it turns up towards the end of the film. Mm. So it's a very odd, strange thing. Now, Neil has said on one basic level, it was actually, because people have written loads of theories about these kind of things. One of the theories is to do with the fairy tale aspect of it. And I don't think he's ever dismissed that it is like the white rabbit that leads Alice down the rabbit hole. So I think he's always seen it as that. He said on one literal level, people would constantly say to him about the script, they'd say, so why did George go to prison? And he'd say, doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Him.
But people would be obsessed about it. And I know this from having worked on development of scripts for so long and working with companies or with individual producers. People get fixated about certain things like that. And they think that it's going to explain a lot about the character or whatever. And it doesn't necessarily. Sometimes it's helpful, sometimes it isn't. So ultimately, Neil said, it's perfectly valid, those people who talk about rabbit as a bunny, that this was his comment on that, I'm not going to tell you, this is the bunny, any bunny you're going to get is this white rabbit. And also, it immediately takes the film to a different level, which is it becomes slightly, I hate to use this term, magical realist.
Mm.
And that carries on through the film. King's Cross with the hookers.
It's like a hellscape.
Well, it never looked like that. It's kind of like Fellini or whatever. Yeah. But he wanted it to have this quality. Steve will always argue that when he did the Scala, there were always, loads of hookers around that area, which is true, that were always around when they were locking up the cinema. You would see all of the girls out there. But what you see on screen is a much more surreal and elevated picture.
I think, because I've watched it a couple of times recently, you can watch it the first time around, you watch it and it's a kind of a gritty, realist drama that with a few niggly things that don't make sense. But then if you look at it again through the lens of it being slightly kind of heightened reality, particularly with Robbie Coltrane's character, who is a budding writer and lives in a weird place in a caravan under a railway arch, and does make more sense when it's a sort of
spaghetti and he's selling the Madonna characters. It's got a totally surreal aspect to it. And one of the things that runs through the story is Robbie Coltrane is telling a noir novel called The Deadly Percheron. It was written in 1946, which is an extremely bizarre book where I think it's a psychiatrist is hearing from his patient. And it's a world that's packed with surreal things, including this horse, the Deadly Percheron, and dwarves, all of which are referenced in the real world during Mona Lisa. At one point, the horse is kind of just on the street somewhere. At the end, in the Brighton sequence, suddenly there's a sequence with two people of restricted growth.
Yeah.
There.
Having a fight.
So running through the fabric of the film is a very surreal story being told to Bob Hoskins, which has led at least one commentator, and I think I've read it on a couple of other things, a couple people, to speculate, because right at the end of the film, we suddenly hear some voiceover from Hoskins, which is quite jarring because there's been nothing like that as a technique before. And then you realise it's not voiceover, it's a carry forward from the scene that we see him in the garage with Robbie Coltrane, and he's now talking about what's happened to him, which of course has led some people to speculate, well, the whole thing is a story that Bob Hoskins has invented, just like Robbie Coltrane was telling the story of Dudley Percheron. I don't think you'd think Neil or David Leland would subscribe to that theory.
Okay. I mean, the reason that holds a bit of water for me, that argument, is that you could see there are people in both the what would be the real life story, as in Bob and Thomas, George and Thomas and his and George's daughter. George is attempting to establish a relationship with his daughter, re-establish the relationship with his daughter, and he builds up slowly, improves throughout the film. And in the what would be in that scenario, the made-up story,
yes,
you've got George attempting to get it together with Simone, but also Simone is trying to get it together with Kathy. So it could be a kind of an analogous, you know, not a strict analogy, but I mean, I can see how that argument could be made. I'm not 100% convinced. Thing is, if it is all reality, if it all actually did happen, I think the ending, which I need to be a bit vague about,
yes,
is a bit weak, because suddenly
there's no consequences. Yeah, for the character.
This terrible thing
that
has happened.
Very, very strange. I agree. I think it's, again, does it matter? Is what I would say.
What
I was struck by watching the film for the first time in however many years is what an incredibly confident piece of filmmaking is. This is a director who's only made two films before, and this film has this tremendous confidence of a group of young people who were really kind of slightly holding two fingers up to the old film industry in the UK. I was a journalist at the time, and I knew Steve incredibly well, and he always had this tremendous sense of purpose and self-confidence, and you can feel it in this film. Like, also the choices of the people involved in it, like Roger Pratt's cinematography is stunning. This is obviously before he did Batman. The involvement, I mean, obviously this is a Palace production, so this is Steve Woolley and his partner Nick Powell, and they obviously came out of distribution originally, and Steve managed the Scala Cinema, so they were screening films, then they set up their own video distribution label, they're very successful at that, and then they start making films. And this film is financed by Handmade Films, which of course...
Yes, let's go on to Handmade, because this is George Harrison's company.
Yes, it is.
Or is it just George Harrison, basically?
No, it was basically George Harrison. So George Harrison, when Life of Brian was rejected by EMI, they were going to be making it, and then Lord Delphont read the script and thought it was blasphemous. So they were suddenly up a gum tree, and George Harrison got a group of people from the music industry, including, I think, Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin, to put money up to finance Life of Brian. And George decided to move forward with that, and Handmade Films became a functioning company. He brought in his old friend Ray Cooper, the percussionist, to run it, because Ray was a kind of absolute film fanatic. And they also had a lawyer, Dennis O'Brien. So they made a variety of films, but they were all kind of pretty distinctive movies that they made with Nil and I and so on. Lou Grade had set up a division called Black Lion Films, which was going to make low-budget films. Anyway, Long Good Friday was made and was not liked particularly by Lou Grade or the people running the company. And they originally had decided they were going to cut it heavily, reduce the violence, and probably dub a lot of the language, bad language, and put it out as a telefilm. And somewhere along the line, it got to Handmade Films, got to George Harrison and so on. And they loved it and picked it up and released it uncut as the film that we all know and love. So there was a connection there with Hoskins, who obviously gives an amazing performance in that film as well. And I think that George Harrison just kind of, he genuinely seems quite involved in all of this, because I think there's a very funny story that the one thing he insisted on, he said he didn't want graphic sex in it. He didn't want full frontal male nudity or female nudity. And they said, okay, we accept that as a principle. And Neil said, for some mad reason, maybe it's Stephen who tells this, for some mad reason, the very first day they shot was the sauna scene where Hoskins is kind of tracking Michael Caine. And it's a male sauna. And they decided to put a camera in the water for the people when they were in the water. So the first day's rushes, which George Harrison attended, mostly consisted of shots of men's bollocks and willies floating in water. Just exactly what they promised they wouldn't do. So they said that was a bit of a rough start. But he was, I think, very, very supportive of what they were doing. You can feel, again, because having worked in the business for a long time, everything from what was he in prison for? What's that white rabbit all about? What about the ending? Yeah, what about this ending? Sure, you know, this can't possibly have happened. Those questions have clearly not been, no one's been troubled with that because people are feeling confident about what they're seeing and what they're making. And it's carried the forcefulness of Hoskins' performance, which I think is amazing. His vulnerability, the fact that he doesn't understand her, he doesn't really understand the situation, but he's trying really hard. He's constantly trying to do the right thing. And when he feels at a critical point of the movie that he's been betrayed, you really feel the anger and the power of that.
It feels like George and Simone are both looking for some, it's such an ugly world they live in.
Yes.
And both of them are looking for something. They're doing something good and kind of precious and, you know, for the benefit of others.
It's a fairy story, yeah, in a way. It's like he is like the prince trying to do the right thing for the princess, in a way. And that feeling of it being a slightly odd fairy story is what permeates the whole thing. And I think does elevate it. What you get is this kind of slightly poetic, strange film that has odd things about it. Now, I personally, while I was watching it again, I kind of felt like it was scrabbling a bit right towards the end. And this move to Brighton, it's fine, but I'm thinking this doesn't feel quite coherent to me. And it, in fact, apparently what kept happening was when Neil wrote something and he'd written 2/3 of it, he couldn't figure out what the ending was. I think that might be correct, actually. Maybe he did a very first version, wrote it, and then got stuck. Then they went to David Leland, who wrote a complete script, but a much tougher one, which had the whole thing in it. And David struggled with what the last act essentially was. And I think you smell that in the film. I think that there's something that, and even the events that happened in the last act, as you say, are even giving it the possibility of it being slightly autistic or slightly fairy story, it's still a bit odd and a bit sudden and a bit unlikely. So I think that it's a film that really has tremendous confidence in the first 2/3. And in the last third, it works because they find a way to make it work effectively. And the power of Hoskins' performance sells it and takes you through. I mean, clearly it worked for a lot of people because the film was invited to Cannes. It won Hoskins' Best Actor at Cannes. He won a Golden Globe for it. He won the BAFTA for it. He was nominated for an Oscar for it.
It did do really well, didn't it?
It did do really well. And you really get the sense, again, that people really, I think people respond to the power of it, of its conviction. As I say, it feels like a group of young people really confident about what they're doing. For me, living in Soho, it's fascinating because, of course, the Soho hangs over the story in a way. They filmed at the Roman Review Bar, which is quite astonishing in a way that they would allow them to present themselves with as, you know, being run by this horrific gangster
with the same
character.
Sign as well, because it says outside the Festival of Erotica, which is what Raymond's Review Bar used to say, didn't it? So I thought
it's got the RR, it's very obviously Raymond Review Bar. There's no way it could be anything else. That's interesting in itself that they were able to film in there. You don't see a lot of Soho other than. And again, it feels suddenly like, oh, why is he doing that? And then you realise he's actually, that George goes off to look for the girl.
He's on a mission.
Yeah. But I felt like it somehow, the way it's cut there, it's sort of suddenly like, oh, what's going on here? Not helped by something, of course, that Neil Jordan loathed, Genesis.
Oh, thank God you said that.
Genesis coming in on the soundtrack with this, what is it, In Too Deep or whatever. And it's obviously a deal that they want to hit. They want a song that could be played that can promote the film. And this must be presumably part of the handmade deal or whatever. It's absolutely hideous because it takes you so out of the film. I think it must be. I thought afterwards they must have chosen to mix it way too loud at the beginning. I think Neil must have been thinking, well, if you want a song, you're going to have a fucking song. So this song bursts in and completely atmospherically sort of wrong, takes you back into your suddenly, where am I? It's kind of, I'm in a wine bar in kind of, you know.
Yeah, with people with shoulder pads. Yeah.
It's very odd, but that sequence is fascinating. It starts in Chinatown and then moves in, and it is absolutely a pocket capsule of Soho of that period. It is the day of the era of the 50 pence peep show or whatever, and they filmed with real girls. That all the girls you see in that section are actually all working girls in the area.
It's fascinating because he turns off Gerrard Street in Chinatown. I think it's the road where the fire station is next to. Almost straight away, you're into kind of peep shows on that side of Shaftesbury Avenue.
Might be the way that they've done the geography for the film, actually. I think that they jump cut a little bit.
Okay. I
hadn't picked because they definitely, it's certainly Brewer Street, Rupert Street, Wardour Street, and Tisbury Court. But it's really fascinating to see in Walker's Court, which is now being
gentrified,
that, of course, that used to have a fabulous butchers at the end of it. And that was one of the most exciting things for me in the film, was seeing Peter Street and Walker Street.
I remember the butchers. I remember that from my first visit to Soho in about 86. Thinking sex shop, butchers, sex shop.
Yeah, there was a butcher's.
And I thought it was great there for the side by side.
That was great. There was also, of course, at a certain period, there was a lampshade shop that I remember from the 70s. And earlier than that, Kenny Lynch had his record store down there.
Yes, he did,
in the 50s. But it's always been a collision of suburban and pornographic in a way. It was always an odd mixture of retail and strip clubs or whatever.
Yeah. Haberdashers.
Yes.
Lots of haberdashery in Soho.
What's happened to you, George?
I'm growing up, Thomas. Trying to look like other people.
You'll never look like other people, George.
Fuck, is that true? Well, she don't think so.
Aye, what's she up to?
She's not up to anything. She's a friend of mine.
She's got to be up to something, George. What do you think this lot costs?
Well, she's a woman of substance. She's a lady.
Oh, I thought you said she was a tart. Tall, thin, black tart.
Well, maybe. But she's still a fucking lady.
I have to say, I can't pretend that I wasn't troubled with 2023 vision by certain things in the film. I think Clark Peters is the ultimate nightmarish black pimp is like difficult to deal with today.
Yeah, and the humorous fighting dwarfs was slightly weird.
Although that, I'm sure, is a directly bit of Neil scattering this strange elements from the Deadly Percheron all the way through it.
I think the black pimp thing, that's another. I mean, some pimps are black, so, you know, he's not. If all the terrible men in the film were black, then I had a problem with it. The fact that just one of them is.
Yes,
quite a surreal, spooky character. Didn't speak much.
Well, he's again, if one's being a tad pretentious about it, he's clearly like a shadow figure. I mean, he literally is this dark shadow figure that is this rumbling, you know, horror that's lurking there. That comes literally out of the. I mean, the most scary sequence in the film is where. Appears in the lift. Which is brilliantly shot. And I remembered from the first time, and like watching it again, I was thinking, oh, this is going to be really unpleasant. Oh my God, this is horrible.
Yeah.
It still has the power to shock that.
And he appears again in Brighton, from nowhere.
Yes.
You mentioned before about looking at a thing through 2024 eyes.
Yes.
I think it's a 2023 eyes.
I don't know why I said that, because I'm kind of like, I'm way past the past. No, 2024 eyes, definitely.
And I mean, I have a thing about slightly yearning for the olden days and the old days of how Soho was back then and everything. But actually, Mona Lisa, you do see the grimness of it all. The exploitation is quite graphic. When he's looking for the young girl.
Yeah, in this real location.
Yeah.
Real locations that with real girls working in them.
And he says, how old do I, or what do you want a name to be? Come back in 2 hours. And he's got some 15-year-old.
Yes, it really, but again, all of this sort of a, you'd seen in Taxi Driver. Perhaps you hadn't seen it so much in British films. But is that true? Because Get Carter is like immensely impactful in the way that, you know, a film made when it's made, 1971, deals with pornography, and he's looking for his niece, and the niece has obviously been used in a pornographic movie. There's that whole world of sleaze and underage sex and so on, I think, is represented pretty well. Soho got really out of control from the early 60s onwards. If you look at, as I think you've done it on already, in Small World of Sammy Lee, which of course is one of the archetypal Soho films, that you really get a sense of what the strip clubs and things were like of that period. Certainly by the time I was coming up to Soho in 74 or whatever, there was absolutely no limits to what you could see or what was shown or what was there in shop windows and so on. But there was this very odd thing. It sounds so weird to say, of course, as like a 14-year-old kid or whatever, I thought this was fabulous. But there was a very odd thing that when I started working full-time in Soho from the time I was 19, it was there, but it was so much part of the world we moved through, you didn't question it almost, which now seems absolutely staggering. I see pictures of, you know, little old ladies with their shopping trolleys going past the most explicit sort of, you know, semi-hardcore or virtual hardcore displays outside the cinemas downstairs, right directly underneath me. That was the Astral Cinema for years, and had huge displays of, you know, kind of the most graphic nature up. And somehow everybody just kind of went, well, that's Soho. That's just the nature of the place. And that's how it is. But of course, what was happening underneath it, no more or no less than I would suggest than what happens today in many parts of London, where you've got poor Albanian girls or whatever tucked away and being abused.
Is it just more blatant in those days?
I think it probably was. And I think now it's probably more undercover, but even more horrific in many ways. And the police were tied so much into that.
Yeah.
The whole point was that they were, you know, there's endless stories of, you know, that they would raid a shop, take everything away, and then a couple of hours later you'd call a number and you'd pay them off, and then you'd get they'd let you buy everything back again. And of course, once the world of films and so on turned into the world of video, it was kind of happy days for them, because you could raid a shop and then replace them all with new videos, you know, within hours.
Thank you to Colin Vaines, who was not chomping on a cigar, for coming on the show all those months ago. I can reveal to you that there's going to be a special one-off screening of Mona Lisa in Soho in the next few weeks, organised by the Museum of Soho. Unless, of course, you're listening to this sometime in the future, in which case it's already happened, but at the time of recording, it's now early January 26th, the date has yet to be finalised, so I will announce it on Blue Sky and on other socials when a date has been fixed. We're no longer on Twitter, for obvious reasons, but you can find us on Instagram, Blue Sky, and even on the YouTubes. So go to any of those platforms, search for Soho Bites, and we should pop up. Blue Sky, by the way, I recommend it. It's very similar to Twitter, but with fewer Nazis. You'll also find details about the screening if you follow the Museum of Soho on Instagram. Feel free to pop over to the show notes at sohobitespodcast.com for a bit more information about the film and about my guests, Colin Vaines and Oliver Carter. You can also subscribe to the show, if you haven't done so already, via one of the many podcast apps listed there. If you'd like to support the show, you can do that by leaving a kind review at sohobitespodcast.com/review, or by deluging me with money to help cover our costs at sohobitespodcast.com/donate. Soho Bites is produced by me, Dom DeLarghi, and is based on an original idea by Dr. Jingen Young. I'll see you in a few weeks with another Soho Noir from a few years earlier. So bye for now.